So now we can go into the Q&A session. We'll be able to take that to 4:30 before our final guided meditation. And for the Q&A, of course, there's three of us heading up this day. So Longpa, Ajahn Kuradhammo, myself. And I think, you know, if it's just a general question, you could, Longpa can take it on. But then if you have specific questions for Longpa, Ajahn Kuradhammo, or myself, you can feel free to ask any of us a question. And of course, remembering, like, Ajahn Kuradhammo was a hospice nurse for a while, and might have different, the three of us might have different experiences with death, so you could direct your questions if you like. And we'll just open up the floor for about 35 minutes of questions.
Thank you.
I suppose my question is following up on what Greg just talked about, which is, how do you deal with suicide and the feeling? Well, there's kind of two questions there. There's one, how do you deal with a friend who has committed suicide and perhaps despair and the grief that comes with that? And then how do you deal with your own feelings of, or helping another friend who has feelings of seeking annihilation, wanting to kill themselves, etc.?
Again, these are really tough emotions to deal with. So that those are very real questions. It's not theoretical. And sometimes we can, you know, we're looking for facile answers to things, and it's important to sort of really be willing to look closely at, you know, well, what are my feelings? And what is, because oftentimes, especially with suicide, oftentimes there's, you know, tremendous amount of guilt or remorse or a sense of what should I have done, what could I have done, I should have done, you know, and all of those second guessing of ourselves, so that there's along with the sense of loss. Because oftentimes suicide is very, very sudden, and oftentimes it's, you know, rarely somebody that's 85 dying in their bed to commit suicide. I mean, it's usually somebody who's younger, and so that there's many more, say, complicated feelings around that sense of loss and so I think one of the things is being willing to acknowledge one's own feeling of gosh, I feel inadequate in the sense of this loss, because it's okay to feel that. But then also, I think one of the things that opens up the more one is able to acknowledge that kind of pain or that sense of loss or that sense of confusion, or that may be there, that there is there's a lot more space for compassion. And that's, I think that is the big sort of, in terms, if we're looking for, well, what needs to be cultivated, or what can I rely on? Then that sense of compassion is really important, in that generating a sense of understanding that universal response to suffering, in that compassion is a skillful or a beautiful response to the suffering of the world, and that wanting to alleviate and being attentive to how to alleviate suffering, and how to respond to suffering skillfully, because oftentimes we, you know, either dismiss it or diminish it or push it away, because it's uncomfortable to suffer. But it's also important to recognize that on a certain level, the word compassion is not quite a Buddhist word, in the sense that, because compassion literally means to suffer with. And you're not trying to just suffer with somebody or something or some situation. You're trying to hold it in the light of recognition of the way beyond suffering as well. And so that's an important perspective to be, because that sometimes the English language doesn't quite hit the mark with the emotional response that Buddhism is pointing towards. So certainly the empathy of being able to feel the suffering of oneself and others, and then to be looking for a wise, skillful response to that, and that doesn't just diminish or dismiss or gloss over, but is also looking to how to rise above it in a way that is skillful and supportive of somebody who is suffering. Because oftentimes we don't attend to, say, the suffering of ourselves and others because we're afraid of it. And to be willing to step beyond that fear, not by being macho, but by be willing to feel. So that response to suffering, response to suicide, you know, one wants to be as empathetic and understanding as possible, but also trying to find a place of clarity and stillness that can be present with that suffering. That's what comes to mind, anyway.
Lumpur, in our group, Lowry and others echoed that in the last moments of death, the very last few moments, that we would have the fruits of our cultivation to bring to that moment. And I've had many things where I was right at death, and that was okay. And I realized I am concerned about the clarity of mind if I have prolonged pain, because I work with that all the time in meditation, and whenever I don't have it, I notice how much better the meditation is. Yeah, it's like, wow. And so I think about this with the clinging to aging, right? Like, I go forward to the future. Is this my life? Now I won't be able to hike ever again. Okay. And then I stop myself, and this is silly, right? So in death, and maybe this is for Ajahn Kunadamo because he's got so much experience, but how does one do that if one is in constant pain? I would think morphine would just dull the mind completely. How does one go day by day? Is it just try to find an hour of good bhavana, or have you experienced how you help people with constant serious pain to try to have some peaceful mind meditation chanting?
Before Ajahn Kurundamo gives his response, I mean, I think I would advocate I wouldn't go too purist on sort of being a Buddhist response. There's also, you know, better living through chemistry as well. You
know? Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, yeah, okay.
Well, you answered it the same way I would.
Yeah, no, just, yeah.
I mean, there's no virtue in suffering through pain if you have an option to be free of it. And also just to give up the expectation that your mind is going to be clear and that that's the best thing. You know, you might not have that option, yeah, whether you take pain medicine or not.
That was my thought.
Yeah. So it's nice to have a clear mind, and we try and cultivate that as much as we can in our practice for the sake of developing insight and things like that. But there are times when, you know, you're in pain or the mind itself is starting to deteriorate, dementia, whatever it is, delirium, pain medicine, whatever, the mind isn't going to be clear. And so the suffering comes when you expect it to be otherwise. So, yeah, do what you can within reason to relieve the physical pain, because having physical pain does, yeah, there's no need to be a hero, a Buddhist hero.
It agitates the mind sometimes. Yeah, it's the agitation. Yeah. It's just too much.
So sometimes it's worth to have pain relief in exchange for a little bit of, lack of clarity.
Also the sense of, because sometimes we try to how do you say, we define things on a moment-to-moment basis and forget that there is a cumulative effect of all of the efforts that we do make, so that we grasp both. On when we have a really clear statement, we say, okay, really, I've got it together now. Or when we don't, then we say, oh my God, I'm falling apart. This is hopeless. What if I die right now? And there is in Buddhist tradition, there is a lot of emphasis placed on the last mind moment, but it's much more of a commentarial tradition than say a sutta tradition from the time of the Buddha. And there's a very beautiful sutta that the Buddha gives to his cousin, Mahanama, who is a stream enterer. And he goes to the Buddha and he's been in town, and he says, you know, and Sir Yuan speculates on his experience, but he goes, well, you know, when you're amidst the impact of the world, things can happen so quickly, and you know, there's all sorts of confusion. You can in the town, and there's noise and events taking place, and all of a sudden you could get, you know, run over by a chariot or trampled by a horse, and you're dead. And you know what? Where would you end up if you died like that? And the Buddha is, God, don't worry. It's basically the cumulative effect of your commitment to the Dhamma and practice of living a life of Dhamma is what kicks in. And he said and the Buddha gives an image, a simile of a clay pot filled with oil with
Alex told us that story at group. Couldn't remember the sutra number. Alex told us that.
Can't remember it, yeah. I think it's in the Sanyutta 55, the on stream entry. Sanyutta 55, I can't remember the number 6 or 7, something like that. Anyway, I could look it up real quick. But anyway, it's an important sutta. In that, it's dropped into a lake, it hits a rock, the pot breaks, the shards fall to the bottom, the oil rises to the top. In the same way, the Buddha is saying, yeah, your body is going to fall apart, but your mind, and the idiom that the Buddha uses, your mind will go to distinction. The mind will go to a good place. And so it's that cumulative effect of living a skillful life, so that continuity of reflection, of death contemplation, of mindfulness, of generosity, of sila, of the whole cultivation of the whole path is what kicks in.
Thank you. In my group, I was the one who was talking about the craving for annihilation and had made that connection just as we were sitting there about mindfulness of death. I don't know if there's a connection there, but it feels like there's something, and even this morning in the guidance about falling away, you know, as I notice myself grasping for things in order to change the way that I feel or to escape, you know, a feeling. And there was even some discussion about, you know, what joy can come with mindfulness of death or just celebrating in some way. So I guess I'm making some connections and curious about kind of more that could be said about, the teachings and just embracing more the benefits, I guess, of this and the ability to be aware of, okay, in this moment I'm craving, you know, wanting to get away from this feeling, so I'm reaching for something, but maybe being able to just be with it more, recall, this is what's happening, and maybe recalling, you know, that desire to just, yeah, the healthy desire to have something fall away. I don't know if I'm making much sense, if this is coming out as a question, but it's just something that's like, it feels like there's something very useful here.
Yeah, there's something really important to be contemplating in that, in the sense, and particularly because there is a really fine line between letting something fall away and wanting to annihilate it. You know, when you say it that starkly, then it's sort of clear. But emotionally and how we feel, yeah, sometimes there's a really fine line of where the mind, and this is where, you know, that contemplation of bhavatanha, vibhavatanha is actually really important. That sense of that desire for non-existence, the desire for non-being, as opposed to being comfortable with cessation. Mm-hmm. You know, there's fine lines there that need to be investigated. And it's really important because sometimes when we, you know, really what's happening is we're sinking into vibhavatanha, but we've got it intellectually couched as you know, I'm comfortable with cessation, you know. You know, we like to sort of pretty it up somehow and make it acceptable, but in reality we just want to get rid of it and push it away, I just don't want to exist. I don't want to deal with this. So it is a really important aspect of investigation. And when, you know, when the Buddha talks of how important or how subtle this middle way is, it is really subtle. And it's one of the reasons why the Buddha himself, you know, on his awakening, said, you know, he spent who knows how many lifetimes with the aspiration of full and complete awakening. And then when he is awakened, he said, nobody's going to, I can't teach this. Nobody's going to believe me. Nobody's going to follow this. So it's that there is a subtlety there that was even daunting for the Buddha. But of course, he spent 45 years trying to clarify it and teach it give us the tools to be able to get a feel for the efficacy of this middle way. And it's a middle way of practice, but it's also a middle way of view, being able to view things in a middle way so that the mind isn't veering towards that being and non-being, existence and non-existence. But there's a middle way of view that is able to see through the extremes that the mind goes to. And that takes a subtlety of training and clarity of heart. And certainly contemplation of death is a really great motivator for how do I understand that more clearly? This is really important, and I need to get a handle on this, because yeah, the days and nights are relentlessly passing.
I also have like a kind of vague question, but sometimes when I contemplate Marana Sati, say at a break during work or something like this, this strong sense of Samvega will come over me, and I say, oh well, work is pointless, I'm not going to do work, you know, I don't want to do work. But I'm currently in lay life, and you know, there are longer term goals, but I don't know, kind of managing Marana Sati in the short term versus long term, you know, because if I get so much Samvega I don't want to work, then this is a problem.
So I've been answering all the questions, so pass the mic.
She's got the mic.
I'm just reflecting, one of the things that we're taught almost from day one, particularly from Lungpa Pasano, is you know, evaluate the effects of your contemplations. If what you're contemplating or the time you're contemplating or the circumstances is leading to a skillful outcome, then it's useful. If it's leading to what might be considered an unskillful outcome, then perhaps it's the wrong contemplation at the time. So, you know, assuming that you need to work to pay the bills, which most people do, in the household life anyway, and that you want to do the best you can, then perhaps that's not the time to to pick up that contemplation, or pick it up, but realize that, okay, well, I can still have a sense of sangwega, a sense of urgency, a sense of world weariness, but that, realizing the practicalities, that's where you pull in the wisdom component. Discernment has to be accompanied with any kind of practice so that you weigh the time, the context, and the effects of it, and realize that, in an ultimate sense, one can feel a sense of weariness at all worldly things, but you're still, in the world. You're still, so you can be in the world, but not of the world. So you just know the time and place and the effects of what it is that you're doing, and use your wisdom to modify any of that kind of more deeper emotional response.
Yes, a good question, because we have to remember the reason for death contemplation. And a reason for death contemplation is to remind us to make the mind as wholesome as possible and as calm as possible in any situation, not just to get away from work or something like that. It's actually, if death contemplation is making us want to get away from work, we need to look at why we're doing it. So it's to remind us even to do our work, to put our full heart into it and make it as wholesome as possible, to be as patient as possible while we're doing any activity. Because then if you were to die at work, for example, then you want your mind to be as wholesome as possible while you're at work. So you don't want to, death contemplation doesn't mean we have to run to the monastery as soon as possible so we can practice. It's more for bringing it back to the moment for whatever we're doing. So it comes up in the monastery as well as at the work period. We might be doing a burn pile or doing some sort of work in the monastery. And it's good to just know that anything could happen at any time, so that to focus on our work and do the best job possible, and therefore the mind will be the most joyful it can possibly be, the most peaceful it can be within that activity. So that's what we're really... Death contemplation isn't an end in itself. It's actually done in order to just remind us to be doing what we can to make the mind more wholesome in that moment.
Let's go back to suicide. I'm a little confused, and maybe other people here are confused. I'm not sure if I entirely understood what you said. I have two questions that are unrelated. The first question is about suicide, and how is that reconciled with the first precept, which is a precept against taking life?
Well, that's why I said what the Buddha said was controversial. I mean, it's been debated for over 2,500 years, so that because of what the... And that's exactly why, say in our precepts, in our monastic precepts, and that attempt of suicide is an offense, because it's even against the first precept. It's quite clear. So taking life and taking one's own life is a life as well. But there are, I was trying not to gloss over the contradictions that do exist. And then the debates that have taken place for 2,500 years, and the commentary glosses that have gone into it, and the machinations that have been—it's tangled. So it's not absolutely categorical, which we would like it to be.
I sure would.
Yeah, but it's, I say, statistically, the injunctions or the encouragement is way more on the side of, no, don't do it. It's not right. It's not according to the precepts.
Okay. I'll go with that.
Yeah.
And my second question, just briefly, I think some of us from the group would like a reference on that Samyutta Nikaya parable or simile.
I could find it in a second.
Okay. We'll just move on.
But we can get back to it.
Thank you.
But it's a great sutta.
Yeah, I'd like to read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of suicide as well, like Lungpa said, it's it's very, very rare for the Buddha to talk about it in that wholesome sense. It's extremely, that's definitely not something any of us would recommend for anybody. It's extremely rare, but there are a couple cases in the suttas where It's called Using the Knife. And there's that, there's just, there is those couple cases, but it's definitely not to be taken as something an ordinary person would be able to do.
Yeah, or taken as a standard.
Yeah, or take it as a standard. Yeah, yeah.
Which is sometimes it is sort of cast in that light. Samyutta 55:22. Yes, 55.
Samyutta 55:22.
Yeah.
Okay, we have time for one more question, brief question.
Not to flog the dead suicide horse, all puns intended. You mentioned the aversion and the other unskillful qualities bringing to any action, including a suicide. But we live in a time where there are these medical prolonging of life.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering about maybe a serious practitioner who at least is of the opinion he or she's, you know, lived a full life and has a peaceful mind and is letting go of that.
Yeah.
And thinks about the expense and all kinds of considerations of this very expensive, say, medical care.
Yeah.
And it's, and let's say it's within the law to refuse this particular set of machines and procedures, then would one have to just really be honest about the cultivation of one's mind state, right? I'm, you know, am I averse or am I not clinging and that kind
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's a practicality there too. I mean, because there's, yeah, you know, say, how do you say, yeah, medically or in medical science side, there's a gazillion things that you can be doing, and you know, hospitals are really happy to do that because they make more money on it.
Right.
But it's, you know, is it practical? Is it useful? Is it beneficial to anybody? And certainly the just that time of relinquishing and letting go is again, there's a fine line. You need to investigate it oneself, but there is a, you know, say an appropriateness to just the letting that. And that's like why, say, in the monastery, most of us, many of us, especially us older ones, who, you know, we have medical directives saying that no, what do you call it? No artificial, yeah, life support and things like that. Because it's if it's not spelled out, then hospitals are obligated, out of fear of lawsuit, to be, you know, taking extraordinary measures and just prolonging life because it is life. But there is a balance where you say that's time to go.
I think this is really important to clarify.
Yeah.
That there is a very significant distinction between refusing artificial life support and actively taking one's life through, you know, some sort of substance that kills yourself or have somebody else do it. Very, very strong distinction between those two, and even that's controversial these days, coming in into more Buddhist discussions. Even people's sense that they should have a moral right to take their own life through active means. So it's a very long discussion, but there is that. Oh, it's very, very strong now.
Oh, I have no idea that was even
sure.
Well,
I guess anything's possible.
Anything's possible as long as you've got people. Okay.